This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Catherine Fritke, and these are the stories you don't want to miss. For the week of June 19th, here are some top stories.
Okay, so we all know it's really, really, really hot outside, like record-breaking hot. But the reality is it's summer. Today's the first official day, by the way. And we live in the desert. Plus, there's a silver lining to all these excessively hot days. With me now to talk about that is Randy Cervini. He is President's Professor of Geographical Sciences at ASU and the record keeper of extreme weather for the World Meteorological Organization. Randy, good morning. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what is the silver lining? Because I think for anybody who has to go outside or step inside a car that has not been under shade or under cover for any amount of time, it seems like that's kind of a stretch.
Oh, definitely, definitely. But there is actually a good thing to this, and that's the idea that our monsoon season, our summer thunderstorms, have to be charged up by hot weather in order to get the moisture that starts to feed into making the thunderstorms that we have. We have to have heat change our wind pattern. And actually, if people have noticed over the last couple of days here, we've actually seen these weird things that I believe the technical term is clouds that we're starting to see. And we're actually getting a little moisture. Our humidity has gone up over the last couple of days as well.
So does hotter temperatures now mean more monsoon activity coming up in the coming weeks?
Well, there's not a good relationship between how hot it gets and how fast or how big the monsoon is. But we definitely need to have the heat in order to change the wind pattern. And that's actually what we're starting to see. We're having thunderstorms that have occurred now in South Arizona. There was some lightning, actually, that started some fires yesterday. And down in Mexico as well, they've had the monsoon starting already. That moisture will continue as we have this heat continuing through the rest of the week. That moisture will continue to work its way up into the state.
Does it affect when we might start seeing monsoon activity? I mean, if it's, you know, still in the upper teens for the rest of this week, but let's say it cools down, let's say even all the way down to 110 or something, does that push the monsoon out further, or is it still roughly going to start at when we thought it was going to start originally?
Yeah, normally the monsoon for Phoenix starts the true season of thunderstorms. I mean, we are technically in the monsoon right now, but the true monsoon thunderstorms start usually around July 7th. And what will happen is we'll usually have a couple days where we'll get some dust storms coming through before we start to have the big rains. So the next big thing that we have to look at over the next couple of weeks is some big dust storm Habub-type situations probably on our southern horizon.
And, of course, when you mention lightning, usually, especially for firefighters, they're worried about whether or not rain follows that. Does the fact that we're having this extreme heat now, does that in any way affect the rain aspect of the monsoon?
Not really. As I say, the heat acts to change our winds, and it doesn't change how much moisture we get. That's dependent upon what's going on right now down in the Gulf of California. But it does change the wind so that it starts to draw that moisture up. So this is a good sign. I mean, it's hard to believe that when you have a temperature of 119 or 117. But this is actually a good sign that, yes, we will probably be having some good thunderstorms here within the next few weeks.
Now, this is at least the second year in a row that we've been approaching 120 right around this time of year. This is above normal a little bit, although it is supposed to be hot now. Is this, do you think, I mean, 2 years a trend does not make, but is this maybe the beginning of what we should be expecting going forward for this time of year?
Unfortunately, yeah. One of the things that I was talking about earlier this week with a colleague was the idea that when you start having more and more high temperature records being broken and fewer low temperatures records being broken, that's climate change. And so it's kind of like if you go to Vegas and you start throwing the dice and you end up with roll after roll of seven, well, you might think, well, there's something wrong with the dice. Well, here, if we have day after day of record high temperatures, that's telling us that there's something wrong with the climate.
What are you hearing from some of your international colleagues when they just read what the temperature is here and even in a place like Death Valley?
they're sending me condolences, actually. But
maybe some sunscreen, too,
right? But actually, the interesting thing is Europe has had a pretty good heat wave going on right now itself. Spain has some really record high temperatures. Even England is having a heat wave, although what they consider a heat wave isn't quite what we have. They were having temperatures close to 90 there, and that's heat wave for England.
Not a lot of sympathy from this side of the pond, or at least this part of the country on this side of the pond, for
exactly.
Heat waves in the 90s. Randy Cervini is President's Professor of Geographical Sciences at ASU. He's also the record keeper of extreme weather for the World Meteorological Organization. Randy, thanks for coming in.
Hey, my pleasure.
And now from KJZZ's The Show, let's talk art from one of your favorite online attachments and my favorite form of communication. Here's the show's Steve Goldstein.
What's in a name or a pronunciation, for that matter? Whether you pronounce it like GIF or GIF with a hard G or even JIF, we're talking about graphics interchange formats, image files you've seen countless times online. But seeing GIFs away from our computer or smartphone screens is becoming a little more common. Recently, the Boulder Museum of Contemporary Art held an exhibit featuring GIFs as part of its Media Live festival and exhibition. Maya Livio is the Media Live curator and joins me to talk about GIFs or some other pronunciation. In fact, Maya, let's start with that. How do we pronounce the GIF acronym?
Yeah, that's a silly but ongoing debate. So the creator of the format has said that it's intended for it to be pronounced GIF. So I'll start by saying that. People have still been debating this even after he said that. And, you know, the G in GIF stands for graphics. So that's a hard G. So some people argue it should be called GIF for that, or sorry, GIF for that reason. I personally choose to call it GIF because that's kind of the way that it's been called historically by more people. And since GIFs are something that circulate online and are very much about being shared and being in a kind of common space among people online, I go by that. I don't think that the creator should kind of own GIF, so to speak, but it's kind of a medium of the people. And so if the people call it GIF, then I will also.
Should GIFs be art, and if so, why?
I think that's a tricky question because I think some GIFs should be art and some GIFs shouldn't be art. To me, where that delineation happens is the intention of the person who created the GIF. So there's been, you know, a long history for centuries about people debating what is art, what isn't art. And every time a new medium comes out, such as photography, screen printing, or any other art medium, then a sort of new debate gets sparked about, should this be considered art now? And so the same has happened with GIFs, and there's different strands of thought, but personally I subscribe to the idea that what should be called art is what the creator decides to call art. So if a creator of a GIF wants it to be considered an artwork and wants it to be presented in art contexts or participating in an art conversation, then I think we should call it artwork. But some creators of GIFs are just making them as jokes or ways of communication or many other purposes. And if they don't intend for them to be considered art, then I don't think we should consider them that.
Is moving into the realm of GIFs in museums, is that an important part of what contemporary art museums do? Sort of challenging old notions and also being more open and accepting to what's out there now?
Yeah, ideas about art are heavily debated, but I personally believe that an important part of art and therefore art institutions is to be responsive to the contemporary condition, responsive to what's going on in the world right now. And so given that mediums like GIFs are proliferating and so many people are using them both in art contexts and in not art contexts, then I think it's the responsibility of institutions like museums to look at those things and to showcase those works and to respond to them and also to preserve them and help preserve them, because that's a big problem with media artworks in general, is that, you know, technologies change very quickly and it becomes hard to conserve these works sometimes. And as the technologies change, sometimes the artworks get lost. And so part of placing these things in museums is that it's treating them with the same kind of reverence and respect that we treat traditional artworks, such as paintings and sculptures, and also showing them the same kind of importance when it comes to conservation, because that's always been a role that museums play in conserving artworks.
I think there would be some who may criticize, they're thinking about originality in a different kind of way, and GIFs are original in a different kind of way.
Yeah, well, actually, lots of GIF artists these days are making brand new artworks that don't appropriate other content, but really are generating brand new content of their own. But even those who do appropriate other content, you know, film stills or other things, this again, yeah, has been a question that's come up in art for a very long time. Where is the line between something that's appropriated and something that is unique to the artist? And I think that part of artworks online in general, and I won't say that this applies to all artists who work online, but many artists who work online now are questioning those kinds of ideas about single authorship and, you know, uniqueness. And that's part of the medium. That's very much important to the medium, that it be shareable, that it be modifiable. I think that we need to start moving away from thinking about artworks as being, you know, created by this sort of single artist genius and being unique. And now that it's online, then, you know, the same thing can exist on millions of computers around the world. And I think that's great. And I think that that's something that many GIF artists and media artists in general are embracing.
Maya Livio is the Media Live curator at the Boulder Museum of Contemporary Art in Colorado. We've been talking about GIFs or GIFs or JIFs as art.
You're listening to the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Here's a story from our Fronteras desk. Businesses in the American and Mexican food and beverage industry are finding it difficult to swallow the new agreement for trading sugar between the two countries. But the deal seems to be palatable for one sector, producers of alternative sweeteners, which include one company in Arizona. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Jorge Valencia has the story.
The process of making sugar begins early for Narciso Hernández Cuevas. He's working his way through his four-acre plantation here in central Mexico. The bright green sugar canes grow 6 feet tall, and Hernández hacks the leaves off of them with a curved machete. The point, he says, is for the stalks to get more oxygen, so they'll grow taller and thicker. And he has to do it while avoiding the brutal midday sun. He says he's out from sunrise until 10 a.m. and from 5 p.m. until sunset. But for all of his back-breaking fieldwork, Hernández is worried about what's happening in offices far away. He says the Mexican government was lukewarm this month in its negotiations for sugar exports to the U.S. The agreement sets limits on the price and the amount of refined sugar that can be sent over, which Hernández and the 6,000 sugarcane farmers here in the state of Morelos say will hit their business. Russell Tronstedt, an agricultural economist at the University of Arizona, agrees. He says there will be winners and there will be losers.
The losers will be the processors in Mexico, and the winners will be the processors here in the U.S.
Tronstedt says the lower supply of refined sugar from Mexico will make American refineries more competitive. For packaged food makers and soda companies, overall cost of sugar will go up by $1 billion, according to the lobby group Sweetener Users Association. But guess what? There are companies for which it's good news when sugar prices go up.
My name is Brian Hall, and I'm the global brand manager for Wisdom Natural Brands.
Wisdom Natural Brands is one such company. Its offices are in Gilbert, Arizona, and it sells plant-based sweetener Stevia. They sell it in grocery stores for tabletop use and in industrial quantities for food packaging.
Energy bars, protein snacks, beverages, mostly natural beverages, tea and coffee.
The global Stevia market will grow by 8.5% annually until 2020, according to an estimate by Future Market Insights. Hall says his company's numbers show a similar picture.
We've seen our sales nearly double over the last year as food manufacturers replace sugar with Stevia.
But that trend is hard to see from the sugarcane field in central Mexico. Ignacio Urueta Herrera is another sugarcane farmer.
Pues yo creo que la unión y todo mundo ahorita estamos pendientes de estos.
Urueta says he and other fellow farmers will pay close attention to exactly how much the new deal changes their income, and that as Mexico enters broader negotiations for trade in North America, they'll figure out a way to get their government's ear. Farmers have long been reliable supporters of Mexico's dominant political party, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, and their vote will be key in the country's presidential elections next year. Jorge Valencia, KJZZ News, reporting from Morelos, Mexico.
In a check of business news, the city of Phoenix is facing a mounting financial issue. KJZZ's Lauren Gilgert talks with an expert on what the pension struggle means for the city.
The Phoenix City budget has been strangled by spiking pension costs for years as the city struggles to pay the benefits for public safety workers like police officers and firefighters. And last night, the city council came up with a plan to punt on paying that pension debt. They voted 7-2 to ask the state-run pension system to allow the city to take an extra decade, 30 years instead of 20, to pay off its debt. Here are a few voices from the meeting last night. Ken Crane is the president of PLEA, the Phoenix Law Enforcement Association.
There's one thing I think all of us in this room can agree on, and that is having debt sucks, okay? Whether it's a note on your car, a note on your house, or a couple of $1 billion in pension debt. Our association looked at this long and hard, and we're kind of, I'll be honest, we're torn on this because I hear what a lot of people are saying about kicking the can down the road, and that's what we are doing. But we do support reamortizing to the 30-year from a 20 to 30 year. It's a yin and a yang. There's an upside and a downside. We realize that by doing this, we are going to incur extra interest debt. We also realize it will give the city some financial breathing room.
And Tom Jenny is with the group Americans for Prosperity, who oppose the action.
I think one of the biggest things we need to do is bite the bullet and recognize we have a giant cost out there that has to be paid. And we should try to start being responsible in this generation rather than passing this on to our kids and grandkids.
Here to talk more about this is Dustin Gardner, who covers City Hall for the Arizona Republic and azcentral.com. Welcome to the show, Dustin.
Good morning.
So, Dustin, this plan sounds like it will end up costing Phoenix taxpayers quite a bit more. Is that right?
Yeah, it's going to cost a lot more over the long run. If they take the full 30 years to pay it back, it's going to be about $2.3 billion. The council has said they want to aim to do it in 25 years, which would still cost over $1 billion extra.
Okay, but in the meantime, in the short term, this would save them some money.
Yeah, so it gets the city some breathing room in the meantime. You know, like you said, pension costs have been absolutely choking the city budget. So this would lower the city's annual pension payments, so they have a little breathing room in the meantime.
Okay. But this has been a growing problem for some time. This has been going on where pensions costs have really kind of affected city services. Give us an idea of how that's affected the budget and how did we kind of get here?
So a lot of things led up to this. You know, I think the market crashes of the early 2000s and obviously, you know, the Great Recession, those had a huge impact on the public safety pension fund, those investment losses. And then also there's been structural changes with the fund. The board that runs the state pension system for police and fire has been changing some of its assumptions to assume a lower return rate on investment, mm-hmm. which basically means that cities and other localities that are part of the plan have to pay more in now. So that's kind of what's been adding up to the cost, but it has been absolutely strangling the city's budget. Pension costs are roughly a quarter of the city's operating budget now.
Wow. Okay. So this was a pretty lopsided vote last night, 7-2. But the two conservative voices on the city council, Sal DiCicco and Jim Waring, voted against it. What did they have to say?
I mean, they think it's totally insane to increase costs $2.3 billion, in the long run in order to, save, I guess, roughly probably $20 million is the estimate, $10 to $25 million in the next year's budget. So they think the city's being, I guess, short-sighted. In its thinking that it's growing long-term costs so dramatically just to get some breathing room today.
Right. So is the argument for it then basically that they had no other choice at this point?
Yeah. The council members who voted for this felt like it wasn't a great option, but it's the best option the city has in their estimation. And they feel that way because the city projects it will have a pretty sizable deficit next year. And they fear that if something doesn't change, that the city might be forced to cut things like libraries and senior centers and swimming pools, just basic services that a lot of residents depend on or really want.
Right. Okay. So how will this immediately affect the city's budget? What kinds of things can they keep that they may have had to cut otherwise?
You know, so this doesn't completely solve the city's budget deficit in the next year. Like I mentioned, the savings, if they stick with this plan to pay it off in 25 years, the savings next year is $10 to $25 million. That gets them, that's the savings in this next year. And then a year from now when they have a deficit, they can have that savings in the bank to help solve the deficit. And it will keep the city's costs lower annually going forward.
Okay. Is it generally agreed, it sounds like, that this was sort of kicking the can down the road?
I mean, they are punting. There's no doubt about that. There's a bill that they're supposed to be paying today based on, you know, the previous assumptions of the pension system. They don't think they can meet that payment without making drastic cuts to city services, so they are punting and pushing it down the road.
All right. Dustin Gardner covers City Hall for the Arizona Republic and azcentral.com. Dustin, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And finally, this week in the world of science, you may have noticed a lot of high pollution advisories in the Valley this year, and many this past week. The advisories serve as a warning that our air has become dangerous to breathe based on standards set by the federal government. But as KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins reports, Senator Jeff Flake is pushing for legislation that would roll back those standards, and it could have a long-term impact on the air we breathe.
Arizona used to be synonymous with clean air, as we can hear in this old commercial for allergy medication.
Yes, Dristan's like sending your sinuses to Arizona. That is, Dristan helps you breathe free and easy.
In fact, people from all over the country suffering from breathing problems like tuberculosis and asthma used to come here to live in sanatoriums and tents. The thinking was the crisp, dry air would be good for what ailed them. But as I found when I moved to Phoenix a few years ago, times have changed. That's me at the doctor's office getting tested for asthma. I passed, or failed, I guess, and now I have to use an inhaler before I climb Camelback. But my doctor told me it's a common tale. In Phoenix alone, almost 500,000 people have asthma. Rising levels of allergens and pollutants generated what we affectionately know as the brown cloud, and that's not good for people susceptible to respiratory problems. In addition to dust and pollen, the valley also has high levels of ozone. This isn't the stuff that protects us from the sun's UV rays. That's way up in the atmosphere. This is low-level ozone, created when volatile organic compounds and nitrogen oxides react in the presence of sunlight.
Researchers and physicians liken it to like a sunburn on the lungs because it's such a powerful irritant.
Paul Billings is with the American Lung Association.
It can trigger asthma attacks, but even for healthy adults, they can start to get into trouble with their breathing on a high ozone day.
He says ozone causes lung inflammation and shortness of breath. The state and counties track ozone levels and issue warnings based on standards set in the Clean Air Act. If ozone levels rise above a certain threshold, the agencies issue what's called a high pollution advisory. In Maricopa County this year, we've already had 26 HPA days due to ozone. Philip McNeely is the director of the Maricopa County Air Quality Department. His agency regulates industries that produce precursors for ozone.
How much they can emit, how many hours they can operate, what type of chemicals they can actually use. And that's one way we control emissions going into the atmosphere.
The county also operates 25 air quality monitoring sites around the valley. There are three sites like this one in Mesa that are still detecting ozone levels above the federal standard. A long tube sticking out of the roof sends air down into a humming equipment room. Ben Davis runs the monitoring for the county air department. He points to a rack of sensors cranking out data.
You can literally watch the ozone levels increase and decrease in almost a real-time method. Generally, what we do for the EPA is required as an hourly average, so we take one number every hour.
One of the reasons ozone is high in the East Valley is because of the geography. Ira Domsky is a consultant with the Air Quality Department. He says polluted air gets trapped in the valley and moves back and forth, creating a sloshing effect.
So at night you have the air kind of creeping down the rivers and the streams and arroyos. But in the afternoon, when the surface of the earth heats up, then it drifts more up towards the mountains.
The East Valley monitoring sites are what's keeping Maricopa County from meeting the EPA standards. The Clean Air Act requires the EPA to evaluate those standards every 5 years. They look at new scientific data and set thresholds to ensure public health. In 2015, the EPA lowered the standard for ozone from 75 to 70 parts per billion. Senator Flake believes the new standard goes too far, too fast. He's introduced legislation that would roll back the ozone standard and move the review period to every 10 years. This is Flake testifying in Congress on behalf of his bill in May.
With costly compliance requirements, this onerous rule will burden counties and businesses already working in good faith to meet the previous standard.
We call that bill the Smoggy Skies Act.
The American Lung Association's Paul Billings says postponing the standards means we'll spend more time breathing bad air.
We've made tremendous progress as a nation over the last 50 years because of the Clean Air Act. We need to continue that progress until every day is a clean air day in every city in the country.
In the meantime, it looks like Senator Flake's bill has resonated with the Trump administration. The new EPA director, Scott Pruitt, recently granted Arizona a year extension to meet the new ozone standard. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Mesa.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Arizona Community Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Alliance Bank of Arizona, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Catherine Fritke, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.